This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. About the Derby, this I know. The horse I bet on will run slow. Unhappily, I've not learned yet to simply watch and not to bet. Even with the advice each year of the Louisville Courier-Journal's Jenny Reese, with whom I speak on Derby Day, I never have much luck with this race. Jenny joins me now by phone from Churchill Downs with, I assume, her customary absolute lock. Jenny, welcome back to Only a Game.
It's great to be back, Bill. I love that poem there. I should steal it. A slow horse is that to me.
You're welcome to it, believe me. For the sake of myths and morals, this race should come down to a battle between Sweet Northern Saint and Sinister Minister. Any chance that happens?
Well, wouldn't that be great fun for the headline riders? But it's really far more wide open than that. Speaking of Derby gods, there's a lot of angles here. They talk about the Derby over the years seeming to reward people for either good deeds or situations. And the fascinating thing about this field is not only are there some really good horses, there's some really good storylines, which really makes it fun for the journalists.
Yeah, not a bad idea to save somebody after an airplane crash to build up some karma on your side, I should think.
That's right. Michael Matz, the trainer of Barbaro, who is the unbeaten Florida Derby winner, was in three Olympiads and won in Atlanta, the silver medal, the team for show jumping.
Mm-hmm.
But that's almost like an afterthought with him. Everybody wants to talk about the fact that 17 years ago, he was on a flight from Denver to Chicago that went down over Iowa, and he helped save three children. And more than that, they might have gotten off the plane anyways. But he and his fiancée, now his wife, Dee Dee, stayed with the kids overnight until their parents, they were flying alone, could get there. And the kids really are quite poignant about the impact he had on their lives because of what the trauma he spared them. And those three kids are at Churchill Downs today as guests of Churchill Downs. They thought it would be so much fun to come to the Derby after Barbaro won the Florida Derby to be 5 for 5. They've kept in touch with Michael Matz. And then they find out the reality of trying to get Derby tickets, like impossible. When Churchill found out about it, though, they made a box available to them, and they are here today.
Jenny, as you pointed out, Barbaro is undefeated, as is the favorite brother Derek. Showing up, which most observers feel will just be showing up, hasn't lost either. How big a deal is being undefeated at this point in a horse's career?
It's a big deal. There's one other horse showing up. It's 3 for 3, and they have the same owners. And it makes Roy and Gretchen Jackson the first owners ever to run two unbeaten horses in the same Derby. They have separate trainers. Showing up is trained by Barclay Taggs, who won the 2003 Derby with Funnyside. But the fact is, if you're really going to be tested, if you're not taking an easy path, it's hard to stay unbeaten by the time you get to Churchill Downs. So there's a certain cachet. It's not as common as you might think to have an unbeaten horse. Sometimes if you have an unbeaten horse, it might be like the Sheikhs bringing one over that's 2 for 2 or something
right
from Dubai, and you have to question the competition.
Jenny, it'll be a big field, 20 horses, the maximum allowed at the Derby, and a lot of the trainers with horses in the outside posts are saying, we'll be okay if we can follow somebody in this field. I've heard that a lot. Is there a horse everybody will be trying to follow early who has a chance to surprise them all and hold on to win?
I don't see a horse going wire to wire in this, but Sinister Minister, that's what everybody figures to be following him, because he figures to be in front. It's just a matter of how long they're following him. The complication with him is he's got a very fast horse inside of him called Keyed Entry. They are in the 3 and the 4 posts, respectively. And Baffert is not very happy that he is by such a fast horse. He was ridden by Patrick Valenzuela, who is a former Derby winner in 1989 with Sunday Silence. But Baffert's fear is that P-Val, as they call him, is really a speed rider. And those two horses, they'll get excited being out by each other, and horses get competitive, and that they'll both go faster than they want. But if there's a horse that's going to be up really close early and keep going, and he's going to be a big price if you're looking for a bomb play, it's Sharp Humor, who is a son of Distorted Humor, who was also the sire of Funnyside, the 2003 winner. Sharp Humor was a very good second in the Florida Derby. He's trained by Dale Romans, who literally grew up on the Churchill Downs backstretch as a son of a trainer, and who has his first Derby starter.
Okay, we've horsed around for long enough. As the saying goes, I think this will be something like your 10th straight year for picking the Derby winner. Who is it this time?
This time it really is going to win, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going with AP Warrior. It's such a competitive Derby that I'm looking for a horse that offers risk-reward. He's 15-1 in the line. The only scary thing about him is a lot of people are talking about AP Warrior now, and it seems like those steam horses a lot of times don't come in. But AP Warrior, he was bought as a yearling for $1.3 million. He bought with the intention of being a Derby horse. He is a graded stakes winner out in California. I've liked the California horses all year long. He was third in the San Anita Derby, but same as with Point Determined, I think he's going to appreciate the change of venue to a less speed-oriented track, and he's going to get the pace up front to be flying at the end. He's trained by John Sheriff, who won the Derby last year in his first attempt with Giacomo, who, speaking of bombers, came in at 50-1. And this is a veritably short-priced horse compared to Giacomo last year.
Jenny Reese writes for the Louisville Courier-Journal and picks the winner of the Kentucky Derby each May for only a game from somewhere between Churchill Downs' Twin Spires. Jenny, a pleasure to speak with you as always.
Well, pleasure also, and I hope everybody picks winners.
To send comments about what you've heard on Only a Game, pinpoint provocative podcasts, rifle through our voluminous audio archives, or see what our cameras have captured when we've been in the field, please visit onlyagame.org. Each of those who own, train, ride, and wager on today's Derby entries hopes to see his or her horse in the winner's circle. But it's a good bet that not too many of them are thinking about where those horses may end up years from now. Kathleen Adams of member station WUKY recently visited one possible destination for time-worn thoroughbreds, and she has this report.
Late on a Friday afternoon, a steady rain falls as two middle-aged couples and their tour guide sit on a well-worn couch and chairs inside the office of Hurstland Farm. They watch a DVD compilation of past performances of Creator, Ruhlman, Taylor Special, and other retired racehorses.
Can't fight anymore. In the Wings is battling on quite well on the outside, but Creator is going to go on and score comfortably from In the Wings.
Once the rain slows, Lynn Niemeyer, a tour guide with Horse Farm Tours, Inc., passes out umbrellas, and the men and women venture outdoors and towards a black fenced pasture. Guide Michael Blowen carries a gray bucket filled with condensed horse treats, which consist of bits of apple, oats, honey, and molasses.
This is Creator on the right. The chestnut horse is Ray Chassaw, who was a big champion at Longchamp. Isn't he handsome, though? I mean, it's hard to believe this horse is 21 years old. I mean, he really does look pretty good.
It's a beauty.
And he's the boss, too. He's totally the boss. Aren't you, Creator?
Michael Blowen made the transition from horse player to thoroughbred advocate after a losing day at the racetrack. While working as the arts and entertainment reporter for the Boston Globe, Blowen frequently made the short trip from his downtown office to Suffolk Downs in East Boston. One afternoon in 1998, Blowen lost a wager when his pick was disqualified. Longtime trainer Carlos Figueroa happened to be standing nearby and offered to teach the journalist about racehorses.
I thought that it would improve my handicapping if I went to work for a trainer. It was kind of like covering the movies. If you knew what happened during the making of a movie, you could write a more interesting story about the movie. And I thought the same thing would happen with my handicap, and maybe even write something about what it was like on the backside of Suffolk Downs.
For the next 2 years, Blowen muck stalls, groomed, and hot-walked the equine athletes under Figueroa's care before heading to his full-time job. When Blowen and his wife Diane White, a Globe columnist, retired from the paper in 2000, the pair moved to Midway, a quaint central Kentucky town dotted with horse farms. Soon Blowen was working for the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, a nonprofit organization that provides retirement options for ex-racehorses.
Some people came to me about starting a retirement home for stallions. I thought that was a great idea because I knew with the TRF, one of the dilemmas we always had is what do you do with these stallions?
Naturally aggressive, stallions require lots of personal space and experienced handlers. But Blowen was convinced the retirees would draw tourists and generate enough income to support themselves during their golden years. Then, just as Blowen was laying the groundwork for his nonprofit organization, he learned that 1986 Kentucky Derby winner Ferdinand had been killed in a Japanese slaughterhouse after his stud services were no longer in demand. plan. Midway's Hurstland Farm agreed to lease 10 acres of land, and the first stallions, Creator, and 1988 Eclipse Award-winning turf champion, Sunshine Forever, arrived from Japan after months of tough negotiations.
It was a good idea for them because they had horses on their farms that weren't breeding anymore that were valuable to us. Everything started to fall into place.
Despite limited space, 15 retirees now reside at Old Friends. They include high-profile horses such as 1984 Louisiana Derby winner Taylor Special and 8-time stakes winner Ruhlman, who ran down Easy Goer and 1989 Kentucky Derby winner Sunday Silence during separate winning efforts.
If you look on the other side, you'll see Ruhlman taking a little interest in that 2-year-old filly that Gene's putting up. He wants to make, that's his girlfriend.
Blowen says last summer, Old Friends averaged 750 visitors a month. David Cordell, executive director of the Woodford County Chamber of Commerce, says the chamber recently named Old Friends the county's number one tourist destination.
Our tourism motto is bourbon, wines, and bloodlines. We've got the flashy thoroughbred farms and the fancy bourbons and wines, but there are not a lot of places in the world where people can go out and pet a thoroughbred horse, animal worth several million dollars, and they can at Old Friends.
While Old Friends does receive support from some former owners, such as Madeline Paulson Pickens, who picked up the $65,000 tab to repatriate two stallions from Japan, Blowen insists Old Friends operates mainly on small donations from horse racing fans like the 9-year-old Minnesota boy who handed him cash he earned from mowing his grandmother's lawn.
We started with nothing. And we started getting these contributions of $10 and $15 and $25. And then we started syndicating the horses that we had here for $100 a share. And we get a broad base of support. And what I hope eventually happens is that everybody steals our idea and that they open up Old Friends in Florida and in New York. And when people realize how much these horses mean to people and mean to these racing fans, that it's going to be good for all the horses when they retire.
For only a game, I'm Kathleen Adams in Midway, Kentucky.
It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce picks the ponies. But first, in the NBA last night, Cleveland slipped by Washington 114-113, and San Antonio swamped Sacramento 105-83. Both teams move on to the second round. The second round of the NHL playoffs began last night. In a wild one, the Buffalo Sabres beat the Ottawa Senators 7-6, while Anaheim blanked Colorado 5-0. Seeds 5 through 8 in the NHL's Western Conference rudely sent seeds 1 through 4 home in the postseason's first round. The biggest upset came at the expense of the Detroit Red Wings, who posted the best regular season record and were favored to win the Stanley Cup. The David to Detroit's Goliath were the Edmonton Oilers, an eighth seed and one of two Canadian teams still skating in the second round. Joanne Ireland covers the Oilers for the Edmonton Journal, and she joins me now on the line. Joanne, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What was the reaction in Edmonton when the Oilers triumphed earlier this week over Detroit?
Well, it was, if they could have lifted the roof off Rexall, I'm sure they did with the sound in that building. It was incredible. I mean, not just to knock them off, but to do it on home ice. One of the goal scorers in the third period was a hometown kid. I mean, you couldn't have written a better storyline for that scenario. And it was wild. I mean, I can't remember it ever being that loud in that building.
Edmonton fans have had to endure much in recent years. Failure to make the playoffs, early postseason exits when they did make the playoffs, the prospect of the team moving out of town, the lockout, of course, which everybody endured. Has the win over the Red Wings made the locals forget all about these things?
Absolutely, and I think, you know, there was a lot of that was forgotten when the season even began with the new CBA and getting Chris Pronger here and some of the changes that they made. But along with that came expectations. So there was sort of, they were chomping at the bit to see this team not only get in the playoffs, but not just bow out in the first round. So this was a huge step for both the team and the community. I mean, if they had to sort of convince them that all things are right in Edmonton, they've done so getting to the second round. And, you know, who knows? I mean, fifth through eighth in this conference, it's a crapshoot. It's just as it was in the first round. This really competitive conference from start to finish.
Perhaps tempering the Oilers' victory was the loss of the Calgary Flames in 7 games to the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim, which I still can't say without giggling. That has to hurt even for Oilers fans.
Yeah, particularly Oilers fans. I don't know so much the players as the city. I mean, they were salivating from here to Calgary, I think, for 3 days, awaiting that. Long before they even got to Game 6, people were talking about that possible scenario. So, yeah, I mean, it would have been crazy. I don't know where they would have got all the beef from to throw on the ice, let me tell you.
What would a Flames-Oilers conference final series have done in terms of restoring the faith of Canadians in their national sport?
Well, I think it would have done wonders, but, you know, I mean, it's just that whole provincial rivalry that stems from football to hockey to anything these two cities do. There's always been a rivalry. But I'm sure in Calgary they'll be quietly rooting for Edmonton here just because they're one of the only two Canadian teams left. And it's going to be a totally different series than it would have been against Calgary. I mean, in San Jose, we have a reporter down there today who said there's nobody at the practice rink, whereas I was at the rink this morning with the Oilers and it was packed. I mean, that's how much interest there is here. So, you know, had it been Calgary, that would have only been multiplied by 10. In San Jose, you could probably subtract about 100. So.
All four top seeds in the National Hockey League's Eastern Conference went through to the second round. Does this indicate a shift in power from the West to the East?
I think we saw a lot of that this year. I mean, there was just the Western Conference, there was not only parity, different game, a little bit more wide open, a little more exciting. And I know the Western teams, the Oilers in particular, they had their struggles against the lower echelon in the conference. But against the East, there just wasn't that intensity that we saw in the West. And I think whichever team comes out of the West will have a much easier time against the East in the final.
Tomorrow, Edmonton will face their second-round opponent, the San Jose Sharks, in Game 1 of the series. Any chance the Oilers come out overconfident, having knocked off the Red Wings?
There could be a little bit of that. There's definitely a quiet confidence that was there before they knocked off Detroit. But they have totally different challenges this time around. San Jose plays a lot more grittier game, and I think the Oilers, if they've taken that next step that they need to take to get anywhere, will go into this, you know, somewhat cautious and not too confident.
Joanne Ireland covers the Edmonton Oilers for the Edmonton Journal. She joined me on the line. Joanne, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
A recent injunction created the opportunity for a high school wheelchair athlete in Maryland to compete alongside the able-bodied. Only a game Sarah Richards attended that athlete's first track meet after the court action, and she files this report.
It's a sunny day in Columbia, Maryland. Dozens of students are wandering by the track behind Longreach High School. They're here to compete at a track event being held in the Howard County School District. Spectators are here to watch athletes achieve personal bests, maybe even break a school or state record. But they're also here for something else.
It's good that, like, I'm getting that everyone's seeing this because they can see how competitive I am and how hard I worked to get here.
Tatiana McFadden is a 10th grader at Atholton High School. Today, for the first time, she's officially competing alongside able-bodied runners. Tatiana is using a wheelchair.
Come on, Tatiana! Go, 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 go!
2 weeks ago, Tatiana was racing the 200 and 400 meter events alone. There weren't any other wheelchair athletes in her school district to compete against. So she filed a lawsuit last March to win the right to race alongside able-bodied students in track events. Last month, she won a court injunction. Now, instead of racing alone, she's sprinting past other runners in the 800 meters. Though she crosses the finish line first, she scored separately in her own division. But she still earns points for her team. After the race, McFadden was happy and relieved.
Like, I was a little bit nervous. I hope everything was fine. I hope people thought it was okay running with me. I think everything went great.
McFadden enjoys shooting hoops with her kid sister in the driveway. She's the kind of gifted athlete who is comfortable playing many sports. She's a Paralympic medalist. She won a silver in the 100 meters and a bronze in the 200 meters at the 2004 Paralympic Games in Athens. She was 15 years old.
The sad thing to me is that Tatiana's the first.
Deborah McFadden is Tatiana's mother. She feels the decision to allow wheelchair athletes to compete alongside able-bodied runners is long overdue.
The law that we sued under was passed in 1973, so it's been around a long time. And certainly you think of the Paralympics, but the fact that people said, you want to run track, why? That shouldn't have even been out there. And it seems to me that our educators should be out saying to students, we want everyone to be involved.
Michael Williams is a coordinator of athletics for the Howard County Public School System. He had been working on developing an interscholastic athletic program for disabled kids for a year before the McFaddens sued. He even teaches a class on legal issues for high school athletic programs, including, ironically enough, how to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Friday morning, I was teaching that class at the Maryland State Athletic Directors Convention and jokingly walked around with a trash can and said, you know, you can just tear this section of ADA out of your manual because it needs to be revised now or will need to be revised soon.
Now, the question looming in some people's minds is whether athletes with disabilities should be allowed to compete directly against the able-bodied. It's an idea that's no longer a fantasy. Kirk Bauer is the executive director of Disabled Sports USA. He says the fastest male Paralympian is only a second off the world's fastest time in the 100-meter dash.
When the athletes are competing and getting times that are similar, then why shouldn't they compete against non-disabled athletes? And if there is a question about unfair advantage, we'll address that when it comes. But right now, we don't even want to, you know, go there. We are so far from there that it's not even, it's a joke. Because what we want to see and we don't see is literally the millions of kids with disabilities that are out there right now who do not have an opportunity even to compete at the basic entry level.
But some people are thinking about the issue of fairness, and they're finding the answers aren't easy. Lauren Young is the legal director for the Maryland Disability Law Center. She's also McFadden's lawyer. She says the judge struggled with this very idea and even asked the McFadden family if they had any suggestions.
He was mulling over, was there a way to score fairly? Is there a way to devise a system where you could do some equivalent looking at speeds of rotations of chairs and body mass, et cetera. Is there any way you could make it equal? And we declined.
The McFaddens told the judge that wasn't why they were in court. They only wanted Tatiana to have the right to race alongside, not against, other students. But Young isn't ruling out a future court case that will address the issue of scoring. And that's bound to rile some sports fans. Howie Nixon is a sociologist specializing in sports at Towson University.
People are very committed to a nostalgic view of sport, and consequently, accommodation represents a threat to that traditional structure. But, you know, by definition, accommodation means you're changing the rules. I mean, people get very upset talking about the designated hitter rule, and one of the leagues has it, one of the leagues doesn't. If people are going to be very passionate about those kinds of things, you can imagine people's reaction to the idea of a person with a disability competing in an established sport by virtue of making some changes in the sport. They have a hard enough time accepting people with disabilities as real athletes.
Are you doing the mile?
It's true that many issues surrounding this case still haven't been figured out. Allison Smith is a teammate of McFadden's. She says she has no problem sharing the track with McFadden, but she doesn't think that they should one day compete against each other.
If she's being scored the same, and if she's, like, say, allowed to be county champion, then I would say it's not fair just because I feel that it's a different sport because she's using wheels and there's momentum involved.
Mark Reedy is a track coach at Hammond High School. He's in favor of racing that includes all categories because, he says, there's more to high school athletics than just the competition.
Schools talk about inclusion. Let's follow through all the way. I'm not really going to say whether it's fair or not, but it's certainly appropriate. I mean, okay, your choice is either you include her or you exclude her. So if we're going to start excluding people simply because they're different, Well, I think we're taking a big step backwards.
Tatiana McFadden says she's looking forward to competing in more races alongside her fellow students. She doesn't think athletes like her will one day race against the able-bodied. But she does say that racing next to her friends is better than racing alone.
When I'm running along the side with everyone, they're like, wow, she's really fast, and, you know, she's just like everyone else.
The legal implications of McFadden's case are far from over. McFadden's next competition is May 10th, the county championships. For Only a Game, I'm Sarah Richards in Columbia, Maryland.
This week, the Houston Astros began negotiations with Roger Clemens' agents for the right to reemploy the seven-time Cy Young honoree for the balance of the 2006 season. Their prorated offer would be worth about $12 million. The Clemens camp has also had talks with the Rangers, Yankees, and Red Sox, so that figure could go higher if the four franchises wage a bidding war. And now there's a fifth team in this complicated and munificent mix, the Brockton Rocks of the independent Can-Am League. Joining me now on the line to discuss the strategy he hopes will land the future Hall of Famer is Brockton Rocks President Jim Lucas. Jim, let's begin with what you're offering Roger Clemens in terms of compensation.
Well, Bill, money really is no object. We're going to give him the maximum monthly salary allowed by the league, and that is going to be $3,000 a month. We're going to have to prorate May because we don't open up till May 25th, so we'll prorate that figure. But for June, July, August, and 4 days in September, $3,000 a month.
It's sounding a little like that Saturday Night Live sketch where Lorne Michaels had a check for $1,000 and all the Beatles had to do was show up and claim it.
Maybe there's a tie-in because Lorne Michaels is a minority owner of The Rock.
Why am I not surprised?
But I'll tell you, Bill, I mean, here's the thing. Somebody with Clemens's numbers, I mean, clearly a future Hall of Famer, deserves an opening day start.
Mm-hmm.
And of all the teams going after him, we're legitimately the only team that can offer him that opening day start on May 25th.
An excellent point, and I understand if the money and the opportunity to start on opening day aren't enough, there are other incentives and benefits that you're offering.
Well, there are. I mean, here's another thing. We have a wonderful relationship with the residents in here in Brockton, and if Roger's family comes to town to see him pitch, we can get him a pretty good rate of about $84 a night over there for the family. That's very good. And then the Brockton High School parking lot, it might be, what, a quarter mile from the stadium. He can park his car there. We will assign an intern to carry his bags back and forth. And then, you know, in the locker room, he can pick any uniform number he wants. Now, granted, the numbers 21 and 22 are already gone, so he's going to have to pick a different number. But, you know, any other number can be his.
Any other number. And maybe whoever has 21 or 22 would be willing to negotiate. That often happens at the major league level.
And I believe at this level, a player holding 21 or 22 would be wide open to that negotiation.
Yeah, $10 or $12 would probably get Roger the number of his choice.
That's meal money. A couple other things, Bill. We are willing to give up the corner locker. In our locker room, he'll have his own rocking chair, and we'll have Roger printed on it, and it'll be on duct tape in case he moves on. And, you know, a couple other quick points. He's never pitched a no-hitter, and the odds of him pitching a no-hitter in this league would be pretty good. And then, you know, another thing is, if he needs Red Sox tickets, we know people.
Now, frankly, I find this utterly overwhelming. Has Roger replied, or have his people gotten back to you?
We have been in contact with Randy and Alan Hendricks and are awaiting word. I mean, I was actually stunned when I saw that nationally the press reported there are four suitors for Roger, and I assumed that we would be one of them. And then to see that the Texas Rangers were the fourth, so we're going to reestablish contact with his agents just to make sure they're aware. You know, the Astros can come up with 10 reasons why they think Clemens should sign with them, but I got to tell you, our reasons make a lot of sense, and he should give this serious consideration.
Jim Lucas is team president of the Brockton Rocks. He joined me on the line from the hometown of Rocky Marciano, Marvin Hagler, and maybe, just maybe, the future home of Roger Clemens as well. Jim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Nowhere to go, nothing to do. I'm a happy roving cowboy. Let me ride that long trail down to the end where the skies are always blue. my song as I ride along. I'm just a happy roving cowboy, herding the dark clouds out of the sky.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, sports meets opera, and at least two people fall down. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
It's Derby Day, and although you've established your reputation as Mr. NASCAR, and none of the horses running at Churchill Downs today will be aided by internal combustion engines, as far as I know, I still want to give you an opportunity to pick a winner.
Well, this is going to be there's a 20-horse field, which means it's going to look like the last reel of She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and somebody who picks horses by the color of the silk or because they had a grandparent named Barbaro is going to win a lot of money. I'm going to pick, only because I like the name, Stefan Wolfer. Mm-hmm. I predict a magic carpet ride to victory.
The Lakers and Suns play Game 7 today to determine which team will face the Clippers. I never thought I'd say anything like that. In the NBA second round, who are you rooting for?
I think at this point you have to root for the Lakers so you get the all-LA series. And you mm-hmm. get these wonderful, lonely, lost in the desert for many decades Clippers fans with their big chance to play the Lakers.
Predictions that Shaq Diesel had broken down, perhaps for good, now seem premature. He had 30 points and 20 rebounds on Thursday night when the Miami Heat eliminated the Chicago Bulls from the postseason. Think the Nets are looking forward to playing the Heat?
Well, I think they are, actually, because the problem, of course, with Shaquille O'Neal now is not that he can't do a 30-point, 20-rebound game. It's that he can't do two of them in a week. I think looking at him, looking the way this season has gone, looking the way the last couple seasons gone, I think the Nets have to be very optimistic that he's probably not only one of these games in him per series.
Charlie, this week NBA Commissioner David Stern estimated that league officials miss about 5% of their calls. Is this a rare faux pas on the part of the otherwise savvy Stern, or did he say it to distract fans who know that the refs blow a lot more than 5% of their calls?
Well, it's an odd thing for him to say because he doesn't specify whether or not 5% of the calls that are made are wrong or whether they just don't call 5% of the offenses. If you want to tell me that 5% of the calls that are actually made are incorrect, I'm going to say that's probably kind of low. If you're telling me that the officials only miss 5% of the rule violations there are, that is a crock of beans.
In the first round of National Hockey League playoffs, all four of the teams seeded 5-8 in the Western Conference have won their series. What did the favored teams have against playing hockey in the spring?
Boy, they just fell down. Edmonton Oilers are a terrific story. And then you've got Anaheim and Colorado. I wouldn't be entirely sure that Colorado isn't going to win the Stanley Cup at this point.
On Wednesday, Earl Woods, father of Tiger Woods, died. He had been battling cancer for some time. Earl Woods, of course, is known for starting Tiger out as a golfer very early and for helping him develop a brilliant career. But I hadn't realized until I read about Earl what an athlete he had been.
He was a groundbreaking African-American athlete at Kansas State. He was the first one to play baseball in the Big 8. He was a catcher, and of course he was a Green Beret. He had determined very early on that he was going to train his son to be not only mechanically a terrific athlete, but mentally and emotionally a terrific athlete, too. And, I mean, we have to say he got lucky because he happened to hit the lottery with a kid who would take the kind of pushing that Earl did.
Two well-known and very successful pro athletes have recently admitted that they have serious gambling problems, and they claim to have lost staggering sums of money. Knowing that things usually come in threes, who comes forward next?
It's hard to imagine, although John Daly claims to have lost between $50 and $60 million gambling and has said, if he's not careful, this could ruin him.
He's down to his last, I don't know, 14 or 15
It's unimaginable million. To me. Of course, you know, in this wonderful country in which we live, if he had lost $50 or $60 million, say, as a corporate executive looting his employees' pension plan, he'd be considered a captain of industry.
Absolutely. The Washington Nationals have new owners. Based on the sale price of $450 million for that franchise, I'd say the interim owner made out pretty well, didn't it?
You know, Major League Baseball put its own self up to sale. I managed to knuckle a $600 million publicly funded stadium out of the impoverished District of Columbia, And it turns out that all that stuff up that Bud Selig was walking around saying about diversity of ownership and maybe, you know, African-American owners for a Major League Baseball team in Washington and maybe Colin Powell would get involved, not so much.
Maybe not. Based on the decision revealed by Major League Baseball this week, is it safe to assume that the 715th home run that Barry Bonds hits will, in fact, create a controversy?
I'll tell you one thing. It's going to create a market because they're not going to certify it. Americans being the entrepreneurial people that we are, you're going to have at least 2,000 official 715 balls on eBay within a week.
Just to clarify it, previous important home runs, they've had a little hologram on the baseballs that have been in play at that time so that they could determine exactly which one was, in fact, the record-breaking
and we do recall Pete Rose being on one of the very early home shopping channels and putting up for bid, I think, at least 9 of the bats he used in the 3-bat at-bat on which he broke Ty Cobb's record.
Pete Rose Jr. in the news this week. He's made a career of minor league baseball for almost a decade. Now he's going to jail for distributing a steroid alternative to teammates. I wonder if he'll make a big splash in the memorabilia market when he gets out.
This is somebody who did not have the easiest life, God knows, or the easiest father with whom to have the easiest life. He was distributing a steroid alternative called GBL, which is something he used as a sleep aid. And, of course, if you take it orally, it converts to the date rape drug, GHB. This is an altogether bad chemical, and he's going to be able to think about it now in a slam.
The excitement of the NFL draft having faded, it's time for college football to return to business as usual, I guess. How else to explain what happened in Athens, Ohio on Saturday?
We must put this in a little bit of historical context.
Oh, good luck.
Ohio University football player Corey Logan is not only not the first athlete to punch a police horse during an altercation, he's not even the only athlete from the state of Ohio ever to punch a police horse in an altercation. A University of Cincinnati basketball player named Art Long did it a few years ago, well, now almost a decade ago. Both of them, I suspect, inspired by the performance of Alex Karras in the movie Blazing Saddles.
And did it very well.
Corey Logan, only pawn in Game of Life.
Marcus Vick was not among the players drafted by NFL teams, Charlie, but apparently he will get a shot to make the pros anyway. Do you like him as a Dolphin?
I don't have any idea. I think the Dolphins looked around and said, well, Ricky Williams is done for the year. Who can we get that will cause us a lot of trouble off the field? I know, Marcus Vick. He's a talented player, and if he manages to walk from point A to point B without, you know, detouring to misdemeanor L, he will get a look and will probably make the team.
And finally, we have spoken before of the curious lack of a National Football League team in this country's second largest television market, which is Los Angeles. You and I might think the arrival of one team in L.A. would sufficiently address that vacuum, but among those who wouldn't agree is California's governor. What's he up to?
Well, he's up to about 34% in the approval ratings, and he's looking for anything to boost that. He wants two NFL teams. He wants one in Anaheim and one in L.A. Now, the NFL is quite happy not having a team in L.A. so they can hold L.A. over any other team that doesn't want to build them an extortionate stadium. So I have a feeling that Arnold is shooting the moon here, but he's in so much trouble with his constituents at this point that it's not surprising.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Phil.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
Walk towards each other doing any of those things. Let's run it real one more time.
The difference is you have to have the balls to punch the other girl in the face.
It's late on Monday afternoon, and the theater space at Zero Arrow Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is dark and a little stuffy. Powdered and rouged, clad in a bright red and sequined figure skating costume and wearing bright red boxing gloves, soprano Kristen Sargent prepares for the dress rehearsal in which she will create the role of Tanya Harding in Tanya and Nancy, the opera. It is an opportunity she could not previously have anticipated.
Yeah, I never imagined I would get to tumble on the ground and throw punches and sing operatically all at the same time.
Tanya's rolling around and punch throwing notwithstanding, Abigail Aldori, the composer of the music for the opera based on the linked misadventures of former figure skaters Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan, insists that the production is not intended to demean anybody.
I really want to stress that this is not a parody and we're not poking fun at people. Obviously, it's a funny opera because it was a funny, it was absurd what happened. And also that sort of goes with my composing style naturally. There's always a little bit of humor in it.
Not perhaps at the time. The real-life drama represented in the opera included not only Tanya's broken skate lace at the 94 Olympics and tears, and Nancy Kerrigan's silver medal performance and tears, but an assault on Kerrigan by Shane Stant, an associate of Tanya Harding and her husband, Jeff Gillooly. That's a circumstance that Abigail Aldori says is front and center in her production.
We've got our opening scene with the first press conferences since the knee whacking. Tanya and Nancy meet for the first time. Then we go into a flashback which shows the knee whacking.
Knee whacking as opera.
Yeah.
This is irresistible.
It's incredible to me. I mean, I wrote it, and every time I watch it...
Oh, 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 I whack your knee. Something like that?
Not exactly.
Shane weighs 300 pounds. Shane says he went to spy school.
Abigail Aldori's accomplice in Tanya and Nancy, the opera, is her aunt, Elizabeth Searle. Needing a subject for the musical composition she had to write for the master's thesis she was completing at Tufts University Music Department, Aldori sought the advice of Searle, who'd written several books. As far as Searle was concerned, there was no question about what the subject of her niece's opera should be.
That was just literally the first thing that came to my mind is, we're going to do Tanya and Nancy. And I told that to Abigail. We both just laughed. And it just struck me, to me, it was a perfect fit. Like, we could do a comic, a darkly comic opera, because I feel like Abigail and I have a certain sensibility we share that I would call kind of dark yet perky. Like
dark yet perky?
Yes, that's my... I've settled on that as a way to describe it. I feel like
sounds like a kind of Tanya and Nancy mind meld going
yeah.
on.
Well, there could be some element of that, yeah.
Searle and Aldori say that 80% of the words in Tanya and Nancy were taken from newspaper accounts. That would explain why a chorus of reporters occasionally chant something like, Gillooly, colluded. But one of the more striking moments comes in a portion of the libretto that doesn't sound as if it was ripped from the headlines. Sure, Nancy actually said, my mother is legally blind, but does anybody remember Tanya responding with, my mother is legally nuts? I asked Kristen Sargent, who plays Tanya, if she felt the real Tanya would be angry at that particular departure from the record.
I hope she wouldn't be offended because I know she's a better boxer than I am. However, I think that it's we take such a meta sort of... I think of these two figures as being sort of Olympian in this opera. I mean, it's opera. It's not even a play. It's not musical theater. We've heightened it to such an extreme that I think Tanya or Nancy watching it would understand that incorporating the way the media perceives the two characters and then also the broadness of the strokes in terms of what they've actually said wouldn't be too close to home. Although there is a lot of domestic reality for Tanya, including, you know, the abusive relationship between her and Gillooly and her mother, that probably would make it something that she might stay home for.
I said to you, come on, it's better than playing the lottery. And Tanya, my wife, finally says to me, yes, you said yes. Come on, Tanya, confess.
According to composer Abigail Aldori, word is that Nancy Kerrigan, too, has found a reason to stay away from the show.
She hasn't commented directly about the opera, but recently she was asked if she was coming to the opera, and she said, oh no, I already know how it ends.
Though the master's thesis of somebody studying music in graduate school would not normally attract much attention from the critics, Tanya and Nancy, the opera, has been the exception. Ever since the librettist leaked word of the project to a friend who knew somebody who worked for Associated Press, Aldori has been fielding inquiries.
It was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. For one thing, the music wasn't even, it was barely started when they got a hold of the story, and it went on the AP, and I'd never experienced anything like it.
Aldori says the publicity was in part a blessing, since it did push her to finish the work. But when the people generating that publicity and the folks responding to it found out how a theater piece that's a master's thesis works, they might have been a little disappointed. Tanya and Nancy the Opera was scheduled for exactly two performances, both of which occurred on Tuesday. Aldori, Searle, et al. May crank the opera up again in a theater at Tufts later this spring, and the composer spoke laughingly of opportunities off-Broadway someday. But at this point, those deals may be almost as iffy as a triple Lutz on a broken lace.
He gave me a good whack!
A good whack! He gave her a good whack! Good whack! Good whack!
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallen. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view my Tanya Nancy operatic photo gallery, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Kristen Sargent, the actress who plays Tanya in Tanya and Nancy the Opera, and she responds to the question, do you get along with Margaret Hunter, a.k.a. Nancy Kerrigan?
Definitely we get along. She zipped me up before I went on stage.
It's acting, Kristen. Acting. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. This is NPR, National